The Nobel Committee has provided me with a new answer to an old question. The old question is the familiar Sunday school complaint, Rabbi, why must I study Hebrew? And the familiar and very adequate answer, of course, is we study Hebrew in order to be able to participate in the worship and in the meaning of our religious tradition. But now I think I have a new and very succinct answer. In order that you can read the works of this year's Nobel laureate in literature, Samuel Joseph Agnon. Agnon and Miss Nellie Sachs are the first Jews ever to have been selected for this prize. Agnon is, of course, the first Israeli and the first writing in the Hebrew language to have been so honored. I do not believe that he will be the last. You may not know these names: Chaim Chaziz, Aaron Meged, Moshe Shamir. They are the leading novelists and playwrights, poets in Israel today. And they're the leaders of a very exciting and creative circle of young and middle-aged Jewish men and women who are bringing about a true literary renaissance in the old holy language. We Jews are truly not deserting the book. What these men have lacked so far has been an audience. They have written, and written well, but they have not had an international reputation, partially because they write in Hebrew. But of course, Hebrew is not an impossible riddle. It can be learned. You know, interestingly, Agnon is the first author to have been honored by the Nobel Prize who wrote in a language other than the language of his cradle. He had to learn Hebrew the way you and I have had to learn it, as young people, as young adults. Hebrew can be learnt. I recommend it to you. That's my last commercial for the morning. But more than that, these works are available in translation. The tragedy is that they're simply not read. Last week, I went into our library and I picked up our copy of the translation of Agnon's Hachnasat Kala, the bridal canopy, which was the one work specifically cited by the Nobel Committee. They compared it to Cervantes' Don Quixote. It was translated into English 30 years ago. Can you guess how many times it was checked out at Ms. Lycan's desk? Less than 10. My hope, then, very briefly, that this honor honors an entire literature, that you will avail yourself of the opportunity to read it, if not in the original, at least in translation, for it's a first-rate literature. It deserves to be read on its own merit. And more than that, for us as Jews, it's an important literature. There are two great creative Jewish communities in the world today, our American Jewish community and the Israeli community. And if we want to understand one another, we must understand the heart and the soul, the pulsating of the cultural heart of each of our groups. And the quickest and easiest and clearest way to achieve this is to read what the writers and the authors of the various communities are saying about themselves and their neighbors. Now, the Israelis read English, and the American Jew does not even read the Israelis in translation. And if we truly believe in a cultural bridge, a bridge of understanding, of mutual encouragement, then surely that bridge cannot be a one-way street. Let me tell you a little bit about Agnon as my contribution this morning to this cultural bridge. And let me tell it to you as he might want it told. He is a storyteller. He is a novelist. Let me tell it to you through his stories. They tend to be drawn from the world of the imagination, hauntingly unrealistic, symbolic in their meaning. You find yourself caught up in the story and suddenly thrust back into the world. You're pleased with the hour of the reading. You begin to wonder what it was that the author really meant. Agnon tells the story, it's a short story, of a Jewish peddler, a pious man, a poor man, who lived in Europe 100 or more years ago. This peddler couldn't keep a whole coat on his back. His clothes were tattered. He had one and one only ambition, one dream, despite his poverty, that somehow he could go up to the Holy Land, and there join the circle of those who prayed for the coming of the Messiah, who bathed themselves in the divine rays of God's presence, which shine more directly on the Jew in Jerusalem and in the Holy Land than any place else on this world. And so he managed to fast several times each week. He managed to avoid buying new clothes when he needed new clothes, and he saved the few kopecks that he could. But he was afraid that his cart might be stolen, that his sack would be taken from him. Where could he keep these few coins that he was hoarding against the day of his in-migration to Israel? If you've been in southern Europe, Greece, those countries, you've seen these little roadside shrines. There's a glass window at the top. There's a crucifix or a statue inside, and usually an alms box below. They dot the roadside. Well, this peddler decided that he would put his money in one of these alms boxes. It would be safe there from the robbers. And when he had enough money, he would collect it, and he would go to Israel. And each trip, each long pack trip that he took, he would bring a few dollars and put it in the alms box. And finally, after years and years of labor, he had enough money to undertake the voyage. And he went gladly to the alms box, and he was seen, and he was arrested by the police for stealing from a poor box, from stealing money that was dedicated to the church. He was brought to jail and brought to trial. And this poor peddler understood almost nothing of the proceedings. He saw only the black cloaked judge sitting high behind his desk. And then he noticed during the proceedings a crucifix hanging on the wall in the back of behind the judge. And at one point he thought that he saw the figure of Jesus, the icon, smile lovingly at him. Sentenced in his cell, he had the sensation that the icon's presence visited him and said to him, "Peddler, you have suffered. Peddler, you have been wrongfully sentenced. I will bring you up to the Holy Land." And then this poor and pious peddler had the sensation that he was lifted up from his cell and he was being taken through the air. And Agnon ends the story by saying, the next day, they found the lifeless corpse of the peddler outside of an old yeshiva in Jerusalem. And we're suddenly thrust back into ourselves when we end this story. It's an ending which ends nothing. We've enjoyed this tale. It's a tale well told. But what does it mean? The peddler obviously is Israel. The rootless, homeless, persecuted, exiled, poor, oppressed Israel, the dark ages of the midnight of the medieval persecution. An Israel which dreams of one dream, to return to freedom in the Holy Land, which prays and plans but is frustrated at every turn, accused of crimes it does not commit, imprisoned for crimes of which it is innocent, hoping always, daring somehow to hope, yet the hopes are always dashed. But what is the icon? And what is the voice? And why the corpse lifeless on the streets of Jerusalem? Agnon himself has interpreted this tale. He said that he wrote it some 40 years ago when the Balfour Declaration had first been written. The Balfour Declaration, you recall, was the promise by the English government. Great Britain looked favorably upon the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, and that she would undertake a mandate of that land with this end in view. But what has an icon and the voice and the corpse to do with the Balfour Declaration? Simply this. Agnon said that he was concerned in those days that there were many Jews around the world who believed that Israel would be handed to them by the men of goodwill in the Christian world. Here was the Balfour Declaration. Here was the promise. There's nothing more that we need to do except to go to Zionist conventions and to pass resolutions. All will be given to us. I was trying to say, he said, that if you listen to the icon, the symbol of the Christian world, and you believe it, you will be born, some of you, to Israel, but the land will be lifeless. The communities will not flourish. I could not foresee then the white paper, the restriction on immigration of the late 30s, the kowtowing to the Arabs, but I knew that if Israel had not the patience to await its own Messiah, it would have to take nation building into its own hands, else the Yishuv would be a lifeless corpse. The story stands on its own, but as in all Agnon's stories, there are meanings within meanings, and this is the delight, of course, of great literature. The style is terse, lean, the images tend to be symbolic, but above all, Agnon never forgets that a storyteller must tell a story, and it must be a story well told. Let me tell you another one. It's a legend. It's called Maase Gedi, the story of a goat. Again, it's the story of the Jewish communities of Central Europe, perhaps 100 years ago, perhaps less. There was a pious man. Almost all of the great heroes of Agnon's story are poor and are pious. And so many of our ancestors fit that description. This man was poor, and he was pious, and he was old, and he was invalid. He was racked by a croupy cough. And such medical advice as there was in his village told him that he should drink the milk of a goat. This was therapy, cure. So he buys a goat. He takes the goat to his field. He hitches the goat to a stake. He allows the goat to graze, and he plans the next morning to milk the goat and to drink the curative liquid. The next morning he goes to his field, and the goat is not. The goat has disappeared. It's gone one day and two and three and four. Then the goat suddenly reappears. Its udders are filled with milk, and the old man milks the goat, and the milk is preternaturally sweet, soothing. It cures his cough. Again he pegs the goat to a cord in the field, and again the goat disappears. And he's gone a day and two and three and four, and he reappears with his miraculous milk in his udder. And this happens a third time and a fourth. The old man is puzzled, and he tells finally his practical-minded son about the mystery of the goat. And the son does something very simple. He takes a long piece of string, and he ties the string to one of the back paws of the goat. And he says, I'll follow the goat and see where he goes. He sleeps at night in the field, and the goat begins to break away from his tether, and he moves off, and the young son follows him. And they travel for a day or two up into the mountains. The goat finally goes into a cave. It goes into the darkest recesses in the back of the cave. And there's a narrow opening. And the goat goes through, and the young lad follows after him. And he finds himself in a green and verdant country, sunlit, cloudless, a beautiful land. Happy farmers in the field, obviously a rich country. And the goat climbs a nearby carob tree and gorges himself on the rich fruit. Then the goat goes to a softly gurgling brook nearby and drinks of the sweet water of the brook. He lies down to sleep. And the young boy notices the farmers in the fields and says to them, where am I? And what is this place? And they answer him, you are in the Holy Land. And this place is near the sacred city of Safat. The young boy rejoices. Now, it was believed by the Jews, the Hasidic Jews of Eastern Europe, that after you had emigrated to Israel and come close to God, you couldn't leave Israel without spiritual damage to your soul. So the young man could not go down Yerida. He had to remain. And so he took a notepad and he wrote on it a letter to his father. I have somehow miraculously been brought by this miraculous goat to the Holy Land. You tie a rope to the goat's back leg, and you two follow him up the mountain and through the cave, and we'll quickly be joined again in family in the Holy Land. And he ties this missive to the ear of the goat, to its horn. And the goat returns, and the boy remains. The aged, pious, poor, infirm father sees the goat returning. He does not see the boy. He's disconsolate. He does not look carefully. He does not notice the letter. And in his anger at the frustration, the loss of his boy, he kills the goat. And as the goat falls on the ground, the letter falls off of its dead body. And the father picks up the letter and reads it. And Agnon ends this story by saying, ever after, the gate of the cave, the miraculous cave, is sealed, and there is no short way to the Holy Land. That's a wonderful story. You could apply to it many meanings. Agnon is saying something about the generational conflict in Israel. There were the pious Jews, the old men, who dreamt of the coming of the Messiah and wanted above all else to go to the Holy Land, but they had to await the coming of the Messiah, and the Messiah never came. And there were the younger men, the more practical-minded men, who somehow found out the footprints of the Messiah, followed the magical goat and got to the Holy Land, and wrote back to their fathers, come up and be with us. And the fathers could not, and they would not. This is one of the great tragedies of the piety and of the energy of the fathers and of the sons. The gates, the short way is closed. The way of the pioneer, of the youth, is open, but the old men cannot take the new way. And all of this is somehow bound together in this legend of a goat. Now, Agnon was born in Galicia in 1888. He was a Zionist from his early days, under the influence of his parents and his grandparents. By the age of 15, he was writing Zionist editorials for the newspapers of Lvov and of Poland. And at 20, he emigrated to Israel. He settled in Jaffa. He got a job in one of the many bureaus of what was to become in time the Jewish Agency. Zionism to Agnon was a spiritual commitment, not a political commitment. He came up in what's known as the Second Aliyah. This was the largest group of immigrants till that time. This was the immigrant wave that brought in Ben Gurion and Ben Zvi, most of the leaders of modern Israel, the men who were determined to establish a political state and a normal people on their own homeland. Agnon wanted something more. Agnon wanted all of the virtues of the past somehow reestablished, not in Israel so much as in the Holy Land. And he did not find them. He found that the young were impatient with the virtues of the ages. He found that they were ignorant of the traditions of the people. He found himself rootless and restless. And after 5 years of living in Palestine, he returned to Europe. And some 30 years later, he was to write a great novel called Tmol Shilshon, Only Yesterday, in which he describes the experiences, the emotional experiences, of a young man who came up as he had done in the early years of this century, who wanted out of his Zionism a religious, a spiritual satisfaction, who found instead the energies and the requirements of state building, and who could not be satisfied with them. And the protagonist of this story, the day before yesterday, Tmol Shilshon, is named Kumer. Kumer settles in New Jaffa, goes on a farm. He cannot be satisfied with the pioneering spirit, with a plow. He gets a job as a craftsman in the city, as a house painter, but this does not satisfy him. He wants the spiritual experience of being close to God. So he goes to Jerusalem, and he lives there in the Mea Shearim, in the community of the 100 gates, with the most pious and the most orthodox and the most unworldly and the most fanatic of those who have come to Israel live. And he seeks in those who are in this group, the Naturae Carta, the meaning of his stay in Israel. He marries the daughter of the most orthodox and the most fanatic of the group. But again, he is left unsatisfied. Because if the religious have the grace which the young lack, the young generation have a relevance which is entirely missing in Mea Shearim. And in one of the few bitter endings in all of his works, Agnon has this young Kumar die, bitten by a rabid dog, a dog's death. And he names the dog Balak, a symbolic name. If you know your Bible, you know that Balak was the king of Edom, who during the time of Moses' wanderings in the desert with the people of Israel, tried to hire the necromancers and the soothsayers, the ancient Near East, to curse the people of Israel. Agnon was saying something about a curse which can rest upon the new state. If it does not somehow satisfy the spiritual requirements, as well as the physical requirements and the requirements of chauvinism and of nationality, which are essential in its being. Agnon returns to Europe in 1913. Like so many young Jews who had left the shtetl of Eastern Europe and sought for a Jewish religious experience and found themselves unsatisfied, he must have thought that he would find it in the great classic literatures and life of the capital in Berlin. The Berlin of Kaiser Wilhelm of the First World War, was too truculent, too belligerent, and too academically arrogant to satisfy Agnon. And though he remains there for 11 years, he is never a part of the university world or the literary world of Germany. He spends his time with Martin Buber, collecting the Wundermeisters, the wonder tales, the happy tales of the Hasidim, which Buber was to publish some years later as the Tales of Eastern Europe, the Tales of the Hasidim. He spends his time as a tutor in Hebrew. He spends his time doing research in Jewish history in the Berlin libraries. And finally, in 1924, Agnon returns to Israel, settles in Jerusalem near the pious, and he spends the next 5 years recreating in novel form the life, the inner life of Hasidic Jewry 100 and more years before. Now, Agnon does not claim in his great novel, The Bridal Canopy, to give a clear, realistic picture of Hasidic life. Rather, he seeks for its inner meaning, its faith, how it brought light into the poverty, how it brought the learning of Torah into the ignorance, how it gave the hope of the return to Palestine to a hopeless generation. Now, the Stockholm Nobel Committee compared The Bridal Canopy to Cervantes' Don Quixote. The comparison is more structural than substantive. Like Don Quixote, the protagonist of The Bridal Canopy sets out on a journey. Like Don Quixote, he's a mystical, unrealistic man. And as in Don Quixote, there's a Sancho Panza, a realistic assistant who continuously brings this man back to earth, to terra firma. But Cervantes wrote his novel sarcastically, ironically, to show up the sham and the pretense of a knightly and military code which Spain had outgrown. And Agnon wrote The Bridal Canopy in love. He shared entirely the feelings, the religious emotions, the religious presence of these Hasidic Jews. Their love of God is his love of God. Their learning was his learning. Their desire for a holy land is his desire for a holy land. And the language is the language of affection. There is no distance, really, between the author and the people that he writes about. These, I suspect, were very happy years for Agnon, years in which he was in Israel, but not of Israel, years in which he recreated in his imagination the world which he delighted in. Then in 1935, Then in 1929, you recall, there was a bad series of Arab riots. Nagnon's home in Talpiot was ransacked and almost destroyed. His wife almost suffered a nervous breakdown during the episode. And Nagnon again left Israel. Reality had intruded upon the idol. And he went back to Europe. And while he was in Europe, he sought for the roots, the warmth, the learning, which he had been writing about all these years, the roots and the learning and the love which he had known in his home. And he went back to the little town of Buzhaj, Galicia, which was his home. And he found, as others had found, that you can't go home again. He wrote a novel about this visit, which he called Oreach Natalalun, A Visitor Lodges for the Night. It's a bitter work. He calls his hometown not by its real name, but Shibush, an error, a transformation, a vulgarization of its previous self. He looks for learning and he finds ignorance. He looks for love of God and he finds skepticism. He looks for proud Jews and he finds the cowering and the fearful. He cannot even bring together a minyan, 10 men for worship, in the synagogue which he remembered from his youth to have been filled with the learned and the pious singing happily of their faith in God. He's destroyed. He now knows that the world that he has built is a world that can never be again. Perhaps it is a world that never was. But really, he's unwilling to give up this world. And symbolically and interestingly, at the end of this novel, he recalls one of the wonder tales of the Talmud. It's a tale which says that when the Messiah comes, all the synagogues, all the study houses of Israel will move themselves bodily through the highways of the world to the Holy Land. And there they'll be open again for business. And he buys from one of the men of the village the key to his old house of learning. And he attends as his last act in the village the circumcision of the grandson of a friend. And as his gift to this little boy, he gives him the key to the closed synagogue, for he is certain that the boy will go to Israel, and at least he will there have the key to reopen the synagogue when it does come. He dreams always of implanting in Israel, of transplanting to Israel, the great virtues, the great affirmations, the great traditions which he knew in the Jewry of Eastern Europe. He lives in that faith. He lives between two worlds, in Israel, but not of Israel. And in a strange way, I think he will achieve his ambition. For this literature, so brilliantly conceived in style and form, has required reading in all of the Israeli schools. The children read it. They can't help but absorb something of its values and of its tradition. And though this world will obviously never be recreated in its traditional form, the synagogues will not be brought whole and refounded in Israel. Something of the virtue, something of the love of learning, something of the all-embracing piety will surely come alive as the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Agnon's generation read his writing. He's a man between two generations, at home in neither. Perhaps this rootlessness, this alienation, is the secret of a great author. His very name reveals this. For Agnon is a pen name. I cannot pronounce his real name. It's something like Shijaskus. And I looked through all the encyclopedias, and I could not find its exact pronunciation. But the pen name is Agnon. And Agnon is a Hebrew word derived from the word aguna. Now, the Hebrew word aguna describes a deserted wife. The aguna was a woman whose husband had left her and was not reported. Many men had to travel in the course of their business during the Middle Ages, and traveling was dangerous. They went on the road, and there were highwaymen, and there were robbers. In the villages where there were the fairs, there were drunken peasants, and there was no police to track down a drunkard who attacked a Jew. Men had to travel, and many men traveled and simply disappeared. And the Jewish tradition, as you know, extremely concerned with the sanctity and the loyalties and the fidelities of the life of the home. And they required actual witnesses to certify to the death and burial of a man before a woman could be declared a widow, before she could be allowed to be remarried. And there were many women, really widows, technically married women, agunas, in each of the towns of Central Europe, whose husbands had gone to market and were simply not heard of again. Now, this prescription against their remarriage was maintained because ever and again, years later, such a man might turn up. He had been captured, sold as a slave, years later ransomed, somehow made his way back to the town. But this is rare. Most of these women were consigned, imprisoned in their loneliness. Now, Agnon is an aguna, a deserted wife. In love with a great, wonderful tradition, he lives in it. It occupies his imagination. It occupies his reading. It is at the forefront of his consciousness. He does not quite understand the new world. He has been deserted by the past. It is no longer. He cannot marry the new world because it's emotionally alien and strange to him. He would like to, but he can't. He comes to Israel, but he remains a deserted woman. In Israel, but not of the land. And of that tension between the generations, between his past and this present, between his evocation of the tradition and the search in a new generation for a new spiritual root, this is the tension which permeates all of his writing. This is the tension which gives meaning to his work. And I suspect that it is in this dimension that his work will have lasting meaning. Because he has made it impossible for the young generation, the Canaanites of Israel, those who care not a whit for the past of their people and care less for the religion of their people, he has really made it impossible for them to grow up without being exposed to it, without appreciating its virtues, without saying to themselves, you know, perhaps there was something there. Perhaps there's a beauty, a sense of orderliness in life, a sense of virtue and personal dignity which we lack. Perhaps we ought to find some ways and to resurrect and recreate this old world and bring it into our own. Agnon's a strange, pixie-like, brilliant, pious, poor, old man. If you want to understand Agnon, perhaps the best way to do so is to understand his response. When the Swedish chargé d'affaires in Jerusalem came to him to tell him that he had been awarded the Nobel Prize, he was overwhelmed. Sit down and have a cup of tea. And then he began to wonder if he could go to Stockholm. The chargé d'affaires said that he'd heard that he had a bad heart, that he might not be able to travel. Don't worry, he said. If my doctor doesn't let me go, I'll find another doctor. But his reasoning is what I leave you with. This is what he said to the chargé d'affaires. There is in our tradition a special blessing that you say when you meet and see a king. I have never in my life been able to say that blessing. I wouldn't deny myself the mitzvah. Amen.